And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. He is ever present, ever faithful, ever under the radar. Vice President Mike Pence became a household name when he accepted Donald Trump's invitation to be his running mate in the 2016 election. From the Access Hollywood scandal to the battles over immigration policy to the Mueller investigation and beyond, Mike Pence has stood by President Trump, defending his decisions and doing his bidding. And in light of the current impeachment inquiry, Pence may now be facing some troubles of his own. But who is Mike Pence? The former governor of Indiana describes himself as a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order. But few really know the man who is a heartbeat away from the presidency. Pence's life and career are the subject of a new book by journalist Tom LoBianco. LoBianco covered Mike Pence from the State House to the White House, and he currently serves as a political analyst for NPR, MSNBC, Fox News, and other outlets. He joins us now with more on his just-released book, Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Tom LoBianco, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Good to be here, Tracy.
Well, let me say at the outset that your book could not be more timely, given the events in Washington. Yeah. It was prescient in a way.
Yeah, we didn't. when we were talking about this, I don't think any of us expected it would be quite this timely. It was pretty stunning. I will say this, though. We all, as my book team and us talked this out when we were kind of putting this together, we did have a pretty good idea that something needed to be written about Mike Pence because he gets overlooked in all of this. And that was kind of the idea. It's like, okay, you know, there's a million books written about Trump, but nothing really being written about Mike Pence. So let's go deep on him and try to understand this guy.
Well, and it seems that one of the central themes of your book is the difficulty of getting to know the real Mike Pence.
Yes. Yeah. And that's, I've covered, what, four governors, two in Maryland, two in Indiana, the Trump White House, Congress, 2016. Of any of the politicians I have ever covered, he runs the tightest shop ever. It is really hard to get information out of that world. It's a very small circle, and they do that on purpose. It's incredible. I mean, the discipline is just amazing.
You mention, or at least the back cover of your book talks about his, quote, deeply repressed personality. What does that mean?
One of the things I noticed when I talked with some of his friends from over the years, and especially people who knew him in like the 1980s and the 1990s, is that he was humorous. He was funny. He was witty. It's not like, you know, if you think of like Trump, he comes off like Andrew Dice Clay, except, you know, not joking about it, apparently. That's not Mike Pence. That's not his style. He has more of a dry and clean sense of humor. And like, you just don't see that now. And I often wonder, I was like, God, what happened to that guy?
Yeah.
Like, I would really like to see that guy. I mean, he would be more interesting. And some people tell me it's still there, but he's so cautious in public that the human gets washed away by the ambition. Yeah. And that's what I was searching for. I'm like, where's the guy who used to make these, you know, really corny jokes? Like, where's that guy?
Yeah, we haven't seen too much of that guy. tell us a little bit about his growing up. We know that he grew up in an Irish Catholic family. Mm-hmm. We know he had a sense of humor. There were those who said that he could have been a stand-up comedian if he wanted to. What else can you tell us about his childhood?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. He is the middle. So the Pence family, they have six children. And it's kind of like two separate groups of children. So the four boys are born pretty close together from 1956 to about 1961. It's four brothers, Ed Pence Jr., Greg Pence is the oldest, then Ed Pence Jr., then Mike Pence comes in 1959, and then the youngest is Tom Pence. The two daughters come later, 12 years later. So Mike is really raised in this group of four boys, and he points this out. You know, some of the best, most revealing information I found about Mike Pence were the interviews he did around his 1988 campaign for Congress. He's more open about who he is as a person, his personal life, his background. You know, he makes a comment in one of these articles published in the Columbus Republic in Indiana. He says that he was the real pumpkin in the pickle patch. He was kind of chubby. He was a little big. He was a little more reserved than his brothers. His brothers were active, athletic, and he kind of got lost in the mix. And there's kind of a middle child dynamic going on there. You know, look, I'll tell you this. I understand that. I was kind of big myself back in school. You know, you lose a little bit of weight. So he loses 55 pounds in the sophomore year to junior year of high school. And it's like he blossoms. He gets that self-confidence, and he's more active in things in public. You see him run for vice president of the student council, student government at Columbus North High School. He doesn't win it, but he does it. And he's getting out there more. He's getting more open. And it's that's a really formative moment in his life. He starts to become more public-facing. He's...
Well, and you're right that he became a very gifted, or it was discovered that he was a gifted public speaker.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. He was, the interesting thing is he was actually always very good at that. In middle school, he used to go to these local tournaments, like not the Elks, I'm blanking right now, American Legion used to put these on. He'd get like second, third place. One of the sisters from, I think it was St. Columba, the parish down there, and the Catholic school that he went to, said that he had this innate talent for it. He was really good. He's good at memorizing things, good at remembering and sort of pulling it all together. So by the time, actually those two things, him losing all that weight, in, I guess it would have been 1976, and coming back to school and then merging that with that innate talent as a public speaker makes him a new man. It makes him a new, he's a boy, but it makes him a new person really.
And we also start seeing his ambition begin to surface, because
yes.
You write about how he started talking about being president one day, even back in high school.
Yeah, that's right. And I do want to point out something, which I think things get kind of oversimplified. Is, we do this, and I do this myself as a political reporter. You hear something and you extrapolate out from there. I've often heard people say, he believes he was predestined for the presidency. That's not entirely accurate. It is accurate that he would talk about becoming president. And, I was out in Columbus, Indiana, signing books and meeting with folks out there. One of his friends from high school came by, and it was really cool. He told me something fascinating, and I think this is true of him still now. According to his friend, Mike Pence tells his mother that he wants to run for president, and this is back in like middle school. And his mother says, "You should do that. I support that." And it gives them that validation, and it gives them that push. And don't we all like that, right? It's, as a reporter, it's not for me to say whether his policies or his politics are good or bad or anything like that. But just like, as I was working this and like finding the human in there, like it made sense. Everything to me made more sense than the caricatures that we see. And let me give you another example further down the line where this comes into play. In 2008, so that dream of becoming president, it kind of gets repressed. It gets repressed by reality. Right. I start off as a reporter and I think to myself, God, maybe I'll be Bob Woodward at some point. Right. And, you get older, you get a little more pragmatic and whatnot. And
reality then, sets in.
Yeah. So Pence in 2008, the movement conservatives in the Council for National Policy come to him and say, "We want you to run for president."
In 2008.
And this is when he starts seriously thinking about running for president and starts changing his tactics and starts plotting the long game. So isn't that just the same thing as when his mother comes to him and says, "You should do it. You should run." It refires up that dream and that passion for him. And everything since then has been running for the White House.
Yeah. We should point out that Vice President Pence declined to be interviewed for your book that ask, and he declined. I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. You're welcome to give us a call with your questions for Tom LoBianco. We're talking about his new book about Vice President Mike Pence. You can call us at 888-477-9499. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. So much, Tom, has been said about the vice president's spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. He describes himself as a Christian first, then a conservative and a Republican. Tell us a little bit about his spiritual journey.
Yeah, that was really interesting to see. In 1978, so he goes off to college, Hanover College. He's a freshman at Hanover, and he kind of gets led on this journey by a man named John Gable, who is his. He is a senior in the fraternity that he's in, the Fijis, the Phi Gamma Deltas, and they're not. It's not like it's not Animal House. It's not like one of those fraternities. a little more staid than that. And he leads them on this spiritual journey. Pence used to go to this thing called Vespers, and it's kind of like a non-denominational Christian worship group at Hanover College, and. In 1978, he sees his buddy John Gable, and he asks him about the cross that on a gold necklace that he's wearing, and he says, "I want to get one of those." And Gable says, "Well, you have to wear it in your heart before you can wear it around your neck." And he sends him off to the Ichthys Music Festival, Ichthys like the Jesus fish, the symbol, mm-hmm. Sends him off to, and it's like kind of like a hippie Jesus Woodstock type thing. In the summer or the spring of 1978, just outside of Lexington, Kentucky, Pence says this is where he has his salvation experience. This is where he becomes born again. Now, the interesting thing about that, though, and this is very true from a religious side, forget the politics for a second, but look at it from a faith standpoint. And this is what I heard from when I would talk with evangelical ministers, historians, people who kind of work in this world and understand it. Conversions can be long. They're not always a clean. It's not all, you know, you hear often the zealotry of converts. That's true in some cases. I don't think it's true in this case and not based on my reporting because, look, he still goes to Catholic Church for another 16 years. So it takes him a very long time. And I think that's also where you see this struggle, that internal struggle to leave his childhood, to leave everything he's known and eventually go full evangelical church. In 1994, is the Greenwood Community Church. It's a long process.
And it sounds like that is a picture of something else that you bring up in the book, which is his difficulty in making decisions,
yes.
His, you know, just hesitancy
yes.
around making major decisions.
Yes. Yeah, that is true. I heard somebody describe it as spineless. It's not, to me at least, I don't read it that way, and I hope that that's not the way it comes across. He's taking in a lot of information. I mean, look, I saw it more from the policy side of things and from the politics side of things. But it is true in his faith also. He takes a long time to make decisions. That's just who he is. And he's calculating when he does it. There's a hesitancy there.
Much more to talk about as we talk with Tom LoBianco, the author of Piety and Power. It's a new book about Vice President Mike Pence. Stay with us. Radio Times will be right back. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscawane. If you're just joining us, we are talking with Tom LoBianco. He is a journalist, and he's the author of a brand new book about Vice President Mike Pence. It's called Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. And it is a deep dive, if you will, into the personality of Vice President Mike Pence, someone who most of us don't know very well. We invite our listeners to join the conversation. You can call us at 888-477-9499. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. And Tom, when we left off, you were sort of telling us about Vice President Pence's childhood, mm-hmm. his spiritual journey, some of his characteristics and personality. I want to start talking about how he got into politics ultimately, because we know that, you know, in college he has a conversion experience, as you described. He did go to law school and worked as an attorney for a short time, but it seems his heart wasn't really in it.
Yeah, he was not very good at that.
So, and he eventually gets into politics. How does that happen?
He comes in as a sort of a ground troop, a precinct committee man in the what is effectively, it's Dick Lugar's political machine in Indianapolis. And this is how everybody gets their start. 1986. And let me use this as a chance to point out that I think this is also where you start to see the importance of Karen Pence, because they marry in 1985 in a Catholic church. They meet in a Catholic church. They marry in a Catholic church. By 1986, he graduates law school. He starts to get active about his politics in a way that he had not been before. I mean, look, it's within 1 year, basically, of him starting as a precinct committeeman that he's already running for Congress in 1988. And it's actually a funny story. He flies out in 1987 to Washington to train at what it's Newt Gingrich's campaign school. Gingrich has taken over GOPAC for folks around here that used to be run by Delaware Governor Pete DuPont. And that was his old political action committee. And he hands it over to Gingrich and Gingrich's right-hand man, Joe Gaylord. Gaylord writes a book called it's a manual for all these challengers. They're trying to retake the House of Representatives for Republicans for the first time in like 40 years or something. I mean, the Democrats have a super strong hold on the House. And Gaylord writes this book called Flying Upside Down. And it's a manual for conservatives, for Republicans, how to run a challenger's campaign against these incumbent Democrats. And the manual is all about how to be an effective attack dog in politics. And the funny thing to me, you know, look, I'd heard the stories, and we've seen this reported elsewhere, that Pence runs a nice campaign in 1988 and a negative campaign in 1990, and he swears off negative campaigning ever again because he feels some remorse about it. That's inaccurate. He runs a negative campaign in 1988 and in 1990, and he does swear off negative campaigning, but not for the reasons that have been stated previously. So look, in 1988, he runs the campaign by the book, by the Gingrich book. He attacks his opponent, and he's very effective at it. He gets within 6 points of knocking off the Democratic incumbent in his very first race for office. So this is pretty heady stuff. He's doing good. The Republicans like him. The Republican leadership likes him. So he runs straight through again into 1990, and he thinks he's kind of captured the wind at his back. In 1990, he runs an even more negative campaign. So he's running the Newt Gingrich playbook even more so. He comes up with this idea. It's at the end of the race. He's losing. And eventually he will lose by 20 points. But there's a pivotal moment in the race in October of 1990. He walks into, and I report this for the first time in the book, he walks into his campaign offices and he sees his campaign manager, a man named Sherm Johnson. And he says that he has a great idea for an advertisement that is just going to rock this world. And Mike Pence is a big fan of Saturday Night Live, which is kind of ironic given the current state of things. He comes up with an idea where he's going to have a man dressed up as an Arab oil sheik, an oil baron, wearing the keffiyeh and the headdress and lots of gold rings and jewelry.
Wow.
And he's going to be thanking his Democratic opponent, Phil Sharp, for sending so much money to the Middle East. And he's, you know, clasp his hands, and Mike acts this out as he's in the office. He clasps his hands up and he says, "Thank you, Phil Sharp." And then he makes an important point. He says, "Look, this Arab man will be wearing two pairs of sunglasses, and halfway through the advertisement, he will take off the one pair, and there will be another pair underneath because, haha, Arabs are always wearing sunglasses."
Wow.
They run this ad against the advice of some advisors.
Does anybody speak up and say that might not be a good idea?
Yeah. Sherm Johnson, the campaign manager, suggested maybe he ought not do it. Some other campaign aides told him he probably ought not do this. But it was kind of in a moment of desperation. And if you look at it, it's sort of the extreme version of Newt Gingrich campaign tactics. It makes sense, right? Everything he's been doing up to that point is in line with that. It blows up in his face in a serious way, and people do not forget it. It's called the dirtiest thing they've ever seen. He feels really bad. After the 19, so he loses by 20 points. After the 1990 race, his friends come to him and they tell him, they're like, Mike, you're lost. Like, we feel like you lost yourself in this. He says this. He says he feels like he lost himself in politics. I will just tell you that I got that same sense, and I heard the same thing now. When he, after he joined with Trump, it was, I heard the same thing from some people, that the Mike Pence they knew got lost in the same way he got lost in 1990 with that advertisement.
And there's a lot that I want to ask you about that. And in fact, we've got a few emails from our listeners, too, about the Trump connection. But I do want to go back to that, to the Arab ad, because certainly that could be perceived as racist.
Oh, yes.
And it raises the question, is Mike Pence racist? Or is he just willing to use any campaign tactic, even if it's viewed as racist, if that accomplishes his ends?
Well, it's over. Remember, it's 1990. It was not at the time not viewed as terribly racist by most, by some people, but other people pointed it out. Like, you know, a liberal columnist at the Indianapolis Star said it was just horrifically racist. So, yeah, there was some debate over it. I think for Pence, I think he kind of gets into this world, and I think this is where you see him with some of the LGBT issues. He gets into a bubble, and he develops these blind spots. Let me give you another great example. I got some videotape from the 1990 race, and I tweeted this out earlier. So if you go through my Twitter, you can find this. I quoted some of this in there. There's actually a great debate moment. In 1990, he's debating Phil Sharp, the Democratic opponent, and he says – they're talking about quotas. And this is back when Teddy Kennedy is thinking about expanding civil rights legislation. And the conservative Republican knock on it is that, oh, this will force hiring quotas. So you will force, you know, businesses to hire X number of black people, X number of, you know, Asian people, et cetera. He gives that answer in the debate. He says, you know, now some people won't bow to this like Donald Trump.
Wow.
But other businesses will be forced to hire X number of blacks, X number of Asians, X number of women. And that's not how we do business in America. And
it's pretty telling.
And that's 1990. And I think that for me, at least what I found in the reporting, it's not that it's a very concerted thing for him. He just tends to go with the flow wherever it is on that side of things.
Yeah. I want to stop for a moment. I have to ask you about Karen Pence, because much has been said about Karen Pence and the power that she has wielded.
Yes.
You know, she's been called even a shadow governor. Tell us a little bit more about her influence.
Karen Pence is hugely important. And when I started covering him back in 2011, some of my sources would tell me, they're like, oh, you really need to understand Karen. That's how things operate. I kind of brushed it off. I thought it was, you know, Democrats would tell me that a lot. And I was kind of like, this is just partisan stuff, you know, spooky ghost stories. And they're real. I was kind of surprised by this. As I pulled back for the book and I was able to do deeper reporting, Karen, I used to think that there were three people in Pence's inner circle, Mike Pence, Karen Pence, and his longtime former chief of staff, a man named Bill Smith. Instead, what I found was not a circle. It's more of a linear type thing where Pence is in the center. He's the nucleus. Karen is the singular gatekeeper to Mike Pence. And then his political aides would kind of elbow each other a little bit to control access to Karen, because that's the only way you control access to Mike.
Hmm.
And lobbyists who I spoke with for this told me that if you wanted to get information to Mike, one of the best ways to move the needle with him is you deliver a big package of plaudits for Bill Smith. And wrapped within that package of plaudits are some niceties for Karen. And then wrapped within the niceties for Karen is a little bug of an idea for Mike.
Wow. And that's how you get access.
Yes.
Yeah. So here's the question everybody wants to know. Mm-hmm. Does he really address Karen as mother?
Okay. Yeah, that's true. So I'm from Baltimore. I'll put it this way. It's signal boosting, right? It's like, I talked with Marjorie Dannenfelser, who's president of an anti-abortion pro-life group, Susan B. Anthony List, and she kind of explained it this way, and it makes sense to me. You know, look, when I'm in Washington, I'm from Baltimore. It's only 45 minutes away, but when you meet someone else from Baltimore, you know, you kind of drop the T in the Baltimore and you start talking about the A's and, you know, start laying on the accent. It's like signal boosting, right? It's a way of, you know, aligning with each other. Pence does not do that until he goes to Washington. And the thing is that, like, one, it's not that abnormal. In southern Indiana, couples will occasionally refer to each other as mother and father. It's not that strange a thing. It is a little dated. But the interpretation I got from folks is that it's more signal boosting. It's like it's a way of identifying, you know, pointing out to other folks, hey, I'm from rural America, too.
Gotcha. So it's not just sort of a creepy, strange way of, of addressing your spouse.
No.
It's a little bit more regional, cultural in nature.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're in Philadelphia and you start calling your wife mother, I mean, that might be a little weird. But I think if you're in southern Indiana, it's pretty normal.
It's perfectly okay. All right. So we fast forward now to he wins the governor's office. In the meantime, he has hosted a radio show. He has gotten a television show. He's become pretty popular around Indiana, hosting those shows and talking about politics and in a pretty even-handed way, I understand, mm-hmm. from your book. But now he is in the governor's office. And we have a question here from Dwight, who says, what does your guest know about Pence's role in voter suppression in Indiana?
I don't know that he was super active in that when he was governor. I mean, look, that's a push by all the Indiana Republicans writ large. And that's kind of a national Republican push. I think that was the Secretary of State who was doing that, Connie Lawson, who, you know, fittingly enough, actually was picked to head Donald Trump's voter suppression panel, whatever that thing was, the one that was investigating the alleged 3 million illegal votes and all that. She was actually tabbed to head that. And Pence was also the chair of that that group. So, the thing to me that's kind of funny is whenever people talk about voter fraud and whatnot, I always laugh because there is an example of voter fraud from Indiana. It was the former Secretary of State, the election supervisor functionally, who had voted from the wrong address outside of Indianapolis. Never changed his address because he was trying to keep his health care on the public rolls. It was a very complicated matter, but long and short of it is there is an example, and it was the former Republican Secretary of State, a man named Charlie White. So if your folks want to Google that, you'll find a lot of interesting stories. I don't know that Pence was involved in it, really. That was more just kind of like a Republican thing writ large. And their argument is that, look, it's about cleaning the voter rolls. They say there's a lot of, you know, dead people still on there, people who've left the state. That's the argument from their side.
Yeah. So before we move on to his time in the White House and some of the issues around his relationship with Donald Trump and what's happening now with the impeachment inquiry, how would you characterize his governorship?
He wasn't terribly effective. Mike Pence is not... he's not really, I don't know. He always struck me more as like a lawmaker, a legislator versus an executive. I'll give you a good example. When I was covering, I used to cover the Maryland State House, and the old Speaker of the House out there, Mike Bush, told me once years ago when Bob Ehrlich gets elected governor and he's been in Congress and the legislature for like 16 years. And Bush sat me down. I'm a kid. I'm like 21 years old. I'm in college. I don't know anything. And like, I'm an idiot. Okay. And I don't know anything about politics. And he sits me down and he says, look, he says, this guy's a legislator. He doesn't understand how an executive functions. So this was what, 16 years ago, 15 years ago, something like that. And I've thought about it a lot ever since. And, you know, as I watched Pence, that's what I felt about him, because his career in politics was 12 years as a legislator. Followed by, you have to check box. We say that he needs to check off the boxes to run for president. And the checking off the box is having executive experience. So when he comes in to the governorship, one, he does not interact with the legislators. He's very hands off. His people will tell you that's because he's deferential to them in a way that the previous governor, Mitch Daniels, was not. Mitch Daniels was a very effective executive, could get a little micromanagey at times, but he was very hands-on. Pence was not. But then the other part of that, and this is, you know, his people will dispute this, is that he was running for president and he was too focused outside the state, too focused outside the building to and functionally, this is where when he gets into trouble in 2015 with the Religious Freedom Act, this is why he gets in trouble, because he does not have in 3 years in office or 2 years in office, he has not developed the pulse for the building. So he doesn't have a sense of how things are working.
And remind us about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and what happened around that.
Yeah, so it's kind of, if you know, the funny thing is that in 2014, the state Republicans, they try to write, they already banned same-sex marriage in the state in 2014, but they want to write it into the state constitution to kind of protect against legal challenges. It fails, and there's massive protest inside the state house. I mean, think about like when they had the union battles in Wisconsin. Think about something on that magnitude. As a consolation prize, the Republican leadership comes up with this idea that they're going to give the religious right a religious freedom bill, which will guarantee that businesses are not forced into serving same-sex marriages. Now, the flip side of that coin, which the Democrats argued and almost nobody listened to at the moment, is that that's discrimination. Hmm. And they made that argument through the beginning of 2015. But they didn't. It did not garner a lot of attention the way that the 2014 battle did. So Pence is not active in these things, and he does not drive a hard agenda. That's not his style. But he sees the possibility to claim a victory with his political base, his old political base, the Christian right. So he kind of swoops in at the last minute and he does a bill signing. And the bill signing and the photo of him with the monks and nuns and these Christian right lobbyists goes viral at the end of March 2015. And the ironic thing is that this becomes his legislation. He had nothing to do with it beforehand. He didn't write it. He didn't push for it. He was totally hands off. But he goes to swoop in for the political victory, and it becomes his.
Yeah, and it ultimately backfires, which
we'll
talk about that, and also about what's going on right now, his relationship with Trump, his legal exposure in the impeachment inquiry, and so forth. Stick around, because Radio Times will be right back. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we are talking about Vice President Mike Pence. He is the subject of a brand new book called Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. The author is Tom LoBianco. He is a journalist, and he has worked for the Associated Press. He's been a commentator for NPR, MSNBC, Fox News, and other outlets, and he joins us here to talk about his new book. We invite you to add your voice to our conversation. Call us at 888-477-9499, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Tom, we left off talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that you were telling us how then Governor Pence sort of swooped in and sort of took the victory. But there was backlash around that. I want to talk about that, and then we want to segue into what's going on today in the Trump administration.
Yeah, the blowback on that, really, it starts from when he does this interview with George Stephanopoulos, and he goes on air, and basically he becomes the national face of anti-gay bigotry. And the activist groups that had been quiet throughout the debate just a few months earlier, now it becomes a national conflagration. And it swarms him. And ultimately, he does back down. And, you know, this, a lot of people have asked me, okay, how do I come to the idea that he's not a theocrat? And I'll tell you, this is one, there's a number of points, but this is one of them. Look, he digs his heels in and says he's going to support this legislation and not back down because it's what's right for religious freedom. But ultimately, he does back down. And perhaps the key thing that makes him back down, and I put this is in the book for the first time, is when a Republican mega donor named Paul Singer, whose son is gay, calls him up and says that I will not give you any money for a potential White House run unless you back down and you sign a quote unquote fix to this legislation, explaining that it will not allow discrimination. So he does back down. And in that moment, it pits his political past, sort of the Christian right, against his future, which are the mega donors that he needs to run for the White House. Now, the irony of all this is that he's so politically damaged by the end of it that they're starting to worry if he could even run for re-election as governor.
Well, and the interesting thing about that is that that's kind of when Donald Trump swoops in, because he's running for re-election, but he's been damaged now, and his prospects are not so good for re-election when Donald Trump comes calling. And one of the things that I was searching for as I read your book, Tom, was in light of Vice President Pence's Christian commitment, was there soul-searching for him, for Karen Pence, about whether he ought to sign on with Donald Trump, given Trump's background and the fact that he is the polar opposite of what Mike Pence claims to be. And I didn't find that as I read your book.
I didn't hear it in my reporting. I didn't find that in the reporting, at least not what I did. Now, you know, I didn't cover everything. It's there's a lot more that I would like to get to. But no, I didn't see that. I didn't see a lot of hesitance, recalcitrance, or whatever. They seemed to be pretty ready to do it.
Even after Access Hollywood,
he hung
in there.
Well, understand this, and I'd heard this before I started work on the book, and I didn't believe it in the moment, but then as I reported it out, I did start to believe it. Their game plan originally was to join with Trump for about 4 months, and when Trump would lose, then they would be catapulted to the front of the Republican nominate pack for the nomination in 2020, which is, I mean, if you're looking for like divine providence, I mean, politically, that's it doesn't get much better than that, going from having your career in ruins to maybe being the Republican nominee. And that's why they did not leave the ticket. Or, you know, there was also that that kind of coup attempt that in October 2016, where the RNC had talked about getting rid of Trump. They don't do that either, because why do that? Everything is logical within that framework. Why would you try to get rid of Trump? Why would you leave the ticket when you know that you could run and become the Republican nominee in your own right in just starting in just 30 days? Just wait.
Well, and that goes to a question here from Cindy, who says, if Mike Pence embraces his Christian faith so much, how can he knowingly stand behind the president who promotes hate and division and bullies everyone that opposes him?
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, there's two biblical allegories that his friends and advisors tell that to explain this. The first one is Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. Where Daniel, they're in exile in Babylon. The Israelites are in exile, and he is chosen by God to keep the mad tyrant Nebuchadnezzar from murdering his people, and he becomes an advisor to Nebuchadnezzar. The other one is Joseph and the Pharaoh, and again, it's the same dynamic. Joseph is tasked by God to keep the country writ large on the tracks, Egypt from falling into a famine. He protects them during this plague of locusts, says, you know, store the grain. Look, both of those go to the kind of the secular argument you hear in political circles that Pence is one of the adults in the room keeping everything on track. I remember I asked John McCain this before he passed away. I asked him about this theory. Is Mike Pence one of the people who's keeping the government on track under Donald Trump? And, you know, he kind of did the kind of slide John McCain thing where he laughs and he smiles and he says, I don't know. I guess it varies from day to day.
Mm. Well, fast forward now to the impeachment inquiry, and Mike Pence's name has been coming up. Mm-hmm. He has, you know, been asked to provide documents and information to the committees that are investigating that call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president. How much legal exposure does Mike Pence have here?
A lot. A lot. I was actually kind of shocked when I saw the level, because he's gotten to where he is by being supremely careful. And throughout the Trump-Russia stuff, the Mueller probe, he was absent in a good way for him politically. But in this, he is wrapped right into the center of it. And that's why when Trump – so look, he Trump's, according to the Washington Post, there's great reporting by the Post, that Trump told him not to go to the inauguration of Zelensky back in May and sends Rick Perry instead. And then in September, he sends Pence out to that European Union trip, and he meets with Zelensky to deliver the message. He's wrapped into it more than I ever thought he would ever get wrapped into something within Trump's world.
And the message is that the aid is still under review, right? That we want to see you root out corruption, and the aid package that we've promised you is still under review. Was that the message that he was tasked with delivering?
I think the gaps in this that will determine whether or not Mike Pence himself gets impeached or is, becomes a serious target or is in any serious jeopardy. The gaps in what we know and what we've heard from him are what will determine this, because he has told us a little bit about what he said in that meeting with Zelensky, but not a lot. So we don't know. We don't know the same level. And actually, that's a big question out there right now. What did he say exactly in this meeting? And that's why it was so damning when Trump says, oh, I don't know, maybe we'll put out your tapes too, Mike.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I wanted to ask you about the president effectively saying, hey, the vice president had conversations with the president of Ukraine too. You ought to look into those. What did you make of that?
I mean, it's him wrapping his arms around him. It's Trump wrapping his arms around Pence, ensuring that Pence cannot be used. This is the way I read it, and this is the way that some of my sources have read this, is that this is Trump ensuring that Pence cannot be used as a method to remove him from office.
So if I go down, you're going down with me?
Is
that where he's going with that? Found an interesting quote, and this came from the 2016 vice presidential debate, where Mike Pence said, and this is a direct quote, "This is basic stuff. Foreign donors, and certainly foreign governments, cannot participate in the American political process." That was from a tweet from Kyle Griffin, who is a producer at MSNBC.
I was driving around Columbus, Indiana, Pence's hometown, with a longtime business owner around there. And he was telling me, he asked me, he's like, oh, you must have found some scandals with Mike Pence. You're a reporter. You know, what kind of scandals are there? And I racked my brain. I was like, it's Mike Pence. Like, there's no sex scandals. There's no financial scandals. He's the only person I've ever covered where I've been 100% certain he has never cheated on his wife and never will. So I'm like, no, there's no scandals, right? If you're looking for something sexy with Mike Pence, I don't think you're going to find it. And then I stopped for a second. I was like, "That, I think I do know the scandal. I think the scandal is the one in front of us where he's said these things in the past. And then by joining with Trump, it forces him to do a complete 180 immediately. There's no assuaging. There's no smoothing over. It's just everything flips on a dime." And I think that was, I don't know if it's a scandal per se, but I think if you're looking for something that's, it's that these are not firmly held principles for him.
Yeah, it sounds as if from your description in the book, Tom, that while he seems sincere about being a person of principle who stands for something, that in certain circumstances, there is some wiggle room.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it seemed to me the higher up he gets, and remember, go back to 2008 when he first seriously starts running for the White House, and this is the long game. The more the ambition takes over, the more he loses of himself. And I heard this from people throughout his career. I talk with people from his radio career, and they're like, "What happened to this guy?" They're like, "What happened to the Mike I used to hang out with on the weekends?" Like that guy. I got that question a lot. His people will tell you that, no, there's, he hasn't lost himself. This is due diligence. He's trying to keep everything on track. They call it servant leadership. But the sense I got from others from around his career is that the higher up he gets, the more he loses of himself, that core of who Mike Pence is, that core, that guy, the more it gets buried under the ambition.
Well, and you wrote conversely that it seemed that when his political career was at a low ebb, mm-hmm. that everything else seemed to flourish. His spiritual life,
yes.
his family life seemed to do better.
Yeah, it was really fascinating to me because they had been trying, it's deeply personal, and Karen Pence had talked about this in an interview with The Federalist, a news conservative website, about how they struggled for 6 years early in their marriage to have children. And almost immediately after Pence stops running for Congress, and so it's, I guess it would have been like about January 1991, they get pregnant with their first child. And in quick succession, you know, Pence has said this, and his daughter, Charlotte Pence, wrote this great book all about lessons from my father, about how his favorite title is dad. And, you know, if I was being a cynical reporter, I might think to myself, oh, this is a put on. No, it's not. That's real. And I think, for those of us who are parents, we all kind of understand that. He gets back in the political arena. There's a great moment in 1988 where he's driving with his old his campaign driver, Ryan Streeter. And Streeter asks him, Streeter is kind of comes out of this the evangelical world, and Pence is still basically Catholic. And Streeter, they're talking about the Bible and citing verse and whatnot. And, I was raised Catholic, so, Catholics generally do not cite verse. we got the Pope between us to handle that, okay? Streeter asks him and says, hey, look, you must know some verse. And Pence is like, yeah, okay, I know a little bit. We used to study Romans chapters 8 and 9. And Streeter's like, well, come on, let's do a little text of biblical dexterity. So and Pence reaches into his glove box and pulls out a laminated card of Romans chapter 8.
Wow.
And he hands it over to Streeter. And, they're just killing time between campaign stops. And Streeter's like, okay, go. And he recites it, and he hits it basically perfectly.
Wow.
And there, in this moment, you see him in between his faiths and struggling to find where he is, but you also see him struggling with how does he live that faith in the political arena.
Yeah.
And he was struggling a lot.
An email from Tom says, it seems that Pence can't help appearing squirmy every time he's interviewed about a controversial Trump move. He looks so uncomfortable in front of the camera, doesn't exude credibility. And Tom says, in the event of the removal of Trump, he will be an unforgettable president for a few months, which sort of begs the question that if Mike Pence does eventually become president, whether it's by impeachment of Trump or by election at some point of his own, what kind of president might we be getting in our last 30 seconds?
Yeah, sure. Let me just point out real quick. He does get flush red whenever you corner him on a question. So that's pretty amusing. A more conservative version of George W. Bush. I think that I don't think he would be a Christian right theocrat. I don't see any evidence of that. I think he caters to that world, but that would not be the only calculation that he makes. A return to neoconservative foreign policy. And not on free trade. I don't think he would do that because the goal would be about winning the presidency in his own right. That's where they are right now. And to win the Rust Belt, you cannot revert on free trade.
Hmm. So do you think, and then I'll squeeze in one mm-hmm. last quick one. Do you see a return to some degree of normalcy? In other words, not the sort of surprise-a-day presidency that
yeah.
we're seeing right now.
Yeah, I think that we'll see the end of Twitter diplomacy. Yeah, definitely that is over. In terms of style, I mean, it would be a 180 completely the other way. And I think, you would see a total lockdown of information coming out of the White House.
Mm.
For us reporters, obviously, that would be maddening. So I think that will go completely the other way. And things will take a very long time to make decisions. Things would go slow.
Well, we'll see how it all plays out. But I want to thank you so much, Tom LoBianco, for being here. The book is called Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. The book has just come out. Our producers today have been John Ahrens, Debbie Bilder, and Kelsey Hansen. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. You have been listening to Radio Times here on WHYY-FM.